Well, good evening, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, well, we, of course, invite your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Mike Rupert. And, of course, I've known Mike since he was, many years. He's been in the wilderness, and he's put out a publication. And, of course, he was very concerned about the relationship between our intelligence agencies, the CIA, and drug smuggling. And then, of course, along came 911, and he put out a great video went into the background of what had happened that day. And since then, he's just been so busy and demand, we haven't been able to get him on the program. Mike, it's good to have you back again.
Hi, Stan. How are you?
I'm doing just fine, thanks. And, boy, your video on 911 certainly had an impact all across America, making people aware that maybe we just weren't getting the whole story.
Well, you know, Stan, I'm really pleased at the way it's held up. We taped that back in November 2001 at Portland State University, and it's still selling like hotcakes because we painted a picture of the world based upon a situation called peak oil, the fact that the world is starting to run out of oil. It's not like a tap is going to turn off, but we're running out of supply. We've used more than half of all the oil God made in 100 years. And I said in November 2001 that we were going to witness this war that Dick Cheney called a war that will not end in our lifetimes, a sequential war to control the last remaining oil reserves on the planet, and that's, by goodness, just exactly what we're seeing.
And, of course, I'm sure you're well aware of the fact that this war was planned long before September
11th. Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And, of course, but the average individual find that difficult to believe, that Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and of course, Paul Wolfowitz and Jeb Bush and Frank Gaffney and William J. Bennett and Gary Bauer and all of these people that most Christians feel are certainly the bulwark of our Christian conservative movement really were planning this war going back to, well, at least 1997, probably even long before that. But according to their own website, according to the information they put out, this was planned long, long, long before September 11th. In fact, it was just like, it was almost like a godsend for them to have that terrorist attack.
Well, the terrorist attack, Stan, was a lot more than a godsend. I mean, it was, I have a book coming out here this fall called Crossing the Rubicon, America's Descent into Fascism at the End of the Age of Oil, in which I lay out very clearly and unmistakably, and this is an academically footnoted book, that the U.S. government not only had complete foreknowledge of the attacks, but actually facilitated them by helping to fund certain members of Al-Qaeda, certain of the hijackers. Five of the hijackers received training at U.S. military facilities, and agencies of the U.S. government kept several of the hijackers out of harm's way so that they could be on the street to perpetrate the hijackers. Then the U.S. government stood back on 9/11 and ordered fighters to stand down when fighters had been successfully scrambled to intercept aircraft some 56 times in the year before 9/11. So the U.S. government went even further than most people understand.
And, of course, there were so many incredible things just to finding that passport that had fluttered to the ground just outside the World Trade Center a block or two away, and then finding another hijacker's passport there in Pennsylvania. Both of them, I always tell people, the hijackers probably rolled down the window on the jet and threw them out so that they'd be found.
Well,
I mean, it's the most incredible story. We even have a picture of the one that was on the FBI webpage, and I guess eventually they thought, maybe the people aren't so dumb that they'll actually believe this, so they took it down. But we got a picture before they took it down, and there was the hijackers passport, partially burned, that just flooded out of that plane. Everything else was incinerated. Even the black box was, I think one of them was destroyed. I think one of them was intact. But that hijacker's passport survived, or somebody was planting evidence.
I think somebody was planting a lot of evidence in a lot of places. Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. There's now a documentary record that a lot of really good researchers, me being just one of them, have compiled. I've identified one supervisory FBI agent in Washington, a man by the name of David Frasca, who single-handedly interfered with five separate investigations that could have prevented the 9/11 hijackings, and this is not by my words, these are by the words of FBI agents in three of the cases. That would be the Minneapolis investigation of Zacharias Moussaoui, the Phoenix investigation by Agent Ken Williams, and a financial investigation run out of the Chicago office into Al-Qaeda financing by Agent Robert Wright. And this one supervisory agent who quashed all of these five investigations brutally was actually promoted just 2 weeks after 9/11.
Well, I guess maybe he had done a good job.
I guess he did. That's one of the big things that's important, although some people take great heart about the fact that Senator Bob Graham, who formerly chaired the Senate Intelligence Committee, is now saying publicly in major newspapers that there is a 9/11 cover-up going on. He is acting kind of as a cover-up himself because he is alleging that 9/11 was a massive intelligence failure when, in fact, the real information that's available now says, no, it was an intelligence success.
In fact, I'm sure you're well aware of that book. It's called See No Evil by Robert Baer.
Yes.
Where, of course, in the foreword to the book, Mr. Baer, who was a CIA agent himself, says that he was told by somebody in the newspaper business, they'd been told off the record by one of the highest-ranking CIA officials that when the dust settled after September 11th, the public would realize that what had happened was not an intelligence failure. It was a triumph. How could it be a triumph when, you know, 3,000 people were dead, unless, of course, it was to take America into this series of wars that we're in right at the present time.
Well,
and the fact that, you know, I'm sure you know that, but so many Americans have never heard of Robert Baer's book, See No Evil, or that statement. You would have think that would have been on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post, and they would have been just hot on the trail to find out who the reporter was and who in the intelligence agency said 9/11 was a triumph.
You know, speaking of the newspapers and all that, you're probably aware that From the Wilderness, my newsletter just ran a full-page ad in the Washington Post.
I had heard it had. I haven't seen the letter, of course. I only get the weekend edition. Tell me about your ad, what you said.
Well, we had one of our subscribers. We've now topped 9,000 subscribers in 33, 34 countries around the world, including now 35 members of Congress. But one of our subscribers had seen my videotape, The Truth and Lies of 9/11, about, I guess, 3 months ago, and he was so incensed by what he had seen. He was a retired business executive that he called up the office one day and said, I'm going to buy you a full page in the Washington Post. You can say whatever you want to. And so that's like one of those questions you like dread ever being asked. Like, Stan, if somebody gave you a full page in the Washington Post, what would you say? That really sets you back. But we hired a great cartoonist. And I went to three colleagues, Catherine Austin Fitz, former Assistant Secretary of Housing, Cynthia McKinney, who is now a former congresswoman from Georgia, but she's been totally vindicated in her questions about 9/11 foreknowledge by the Bush administration and profiteering by companies allied to the Bush administration, and Francis Boyle, professor of law at the University of Illinois, who have been out there about 9/11 and government criminal behavior for a long time. And I went to them, and I got three separate statements from them. And then I wrote a whole bunch of very pointed factual statements about 9/11, about what's happened with drugs since 9/11, the fact that Afghanistan, under CIA control, is now producing more heroin than any country on the earth, even though the Taliban had destroyed all the opium in the country before 9/11. We've talked about $3.3 trillion of taxpayer money that's been stolen from the Pentagon. Gone. It's just missing. $3.3 trillion. That's enough to fund every budget deficit in the country right now. and Social Security, which has been looted. And we talked about peak oil and the fact that oil reserves are running out all over the country, and America is about to face a monstrous natural gas crisis probably this summer, which will result in massive brownouts, maybe even some blackouts. And the fact that planet Earth is in deep trouble over lack of energy supplies. And this ad was extremely well received. And in the first draft of the ad, both Catherine Austin Fitz and I had sharply criticized Army Secretary Tom White, who was a former executive with Enron, who had made probably $200 million of insider trading Enron stock before the company went bankrupt. Then he became Secretary of the Army, and he submitted a statement to Congress this year that said that he couldn't balance the Army's books because of the damage from the attacks on the Pentagon on 9/11. Well, people who follow 9/11 know clearly that it was the Navy wing of the Pentagon that was struck. It didn't affect the Army at all. So here we have a guy who was looting Enron, now helping to loot the Army, or so it appeared. Now, before the ad could run, we had a two-week window when the ad was going to run. We couldn't control the exact day. It got to the Washington Post from the ad broker, and 2 days later, Tom White was fired. And that was before the ad ran. So the Post tried to stifle the ad, certainly a number of people in Washington did. But we got a chance to rewrite it and correct that, and our ad agent went to bat and threatened to pull his $5 million a year business with the broker if they didn't run the ad, and they ran it. So now we have started a new drive. Because the response from around the country has been so incredible, we have secured an incredible ad buy to run it in the 14 largest newspapers in the country simultaneously for only $100,000 as opposed to $500,000. And we've asked our subscribers, and we have raised $60,000, $59,000 in less than a week. That's
really is wonderful, and that's really exciting. And I'm a little envious that you raised that much money. I wish we could, but on the other hand, I'm so glad that you have, because you know it's so important that we utilize every means we can.
That's right.
And you can reach so many people running ads. Now, how many newspapers do you plan to run it in?
This will run in the 14 largest newspapers in the country. That's the Washington Post, again, the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, Los Angeles Times, Dallas Morning News, the Miami Herald, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Denver Post, San Francisco Chronicle, 14 largest papers in the country.
Boy, that's really going to have a tremendous, tremendous impact.
And we're having all the contributions sent directly to the ad agency. We're not touching the money here from the wilderness. That's just going into an escrow account, so if the ad doesn't run, it all goes back. But it's going to run. I mean, we've raised $60,000 in less than a week because people, you know, have been saying, what can I do to reach the rest of my countrymen? And this is a way to do it. If anybody wants to see the first ad that we ran or find out about the new ad, it's the same basic ad. They can see that at our website, which is www.fromthewilderness.com.
Now, right, that's fromthewilderness.com, and I recommend it strongly. Fascinating website. Fascinating information, you know, on the CIA involvement in drugs. And, you know, most Americans find it difficult to believe that our government, which is fighting a war on drugs, is actually the CIA is promoting drugs. Well, we had a war on poverty, and we lost the war on poverty. We have a war on cancer, and we've got more cancer than we ever had before. We've had a war on drugs, and of course, we have certainly it continues, and we have a war on terrorism, and gee, but we can't seem to find the master arch terrorist. His name is Osama bin Laden, yes, and then we had a war in Iraq to get the wicked Saddam Hussein, and of course we can't find the wicked Saddam Hussein. There's something wrong with all these wars, and when are the American people going to wake up? Do you think they're waking up at all, Mike?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do, and I think that they're waking up in part because they can see their own quality of life deteriorating. And part of that is due to peak oil and the fact that the world is running out of energy supplies, but certainly a great deal of mismanagement and criminality on behalf of the Bush administration and the Clinton administration before. But we have 2 million unemployed in the last 2 years. The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation is insolvent. Social Security has been looted. Medicare is in great jeopardy right now. The economy is falling to pieces, both through neglect and through criminal conduct. And And this is starting to wake people up. And, of course, this never-ending charade of a terrorist under every pillow and an atom bomb that doesn't exist and weapons of mass destruction that haven't been found is really starting to wear thin, I think, with the American people.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, there's just so many aspects of what's going on. And, of course, as you point out, you know, we're in real trouble financially. And so what's the solution? Why, we're going to, of course, give them a tax cut. Now, it's not a great tax cut, but certainly all Americans will get a little bit of money out of that. But, of course, where is the money coming from? Why, we're borrowing it from future generations. And of course, eventually, that money is going to have to be paid back. Either that, or they're going to have to destroy the whole financial system and, of course, start from scratch all over again, which means that they will wipe out the middle class, and this may well be what's going to happen down the line. There's never been a country that spent itself into prosperity, and yet, of course, that's what they're trying to do. Well, you know, let's get into some of the things that you've been uncovered as far as 911. Let's get your take on it. You mentioned that five of the hijackers had actually been trained at American facilities.
That's correct. Mohammed Atta and Al-Shehi had received flight training Mohammed Atta trained at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. Two of them, Al-Shehi and one other, had trained at Pensacola Naval Air Station. And apparently Mohammed Atta and two other hijackers also received English language training at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey.
Whatever happened to that military officer, the Lieutenant
Colonel? Butler, yeah.
Right, whatever happened to him? Of course, he wrote a letter to the Monterey Herald saying that he was sure the President had advanced knowledge because he mentioned at least one of these people had gone to the Defense Language School. I mean, why would a hijacker be given a security clearance to go to the Defense Language School?
Yeah, this is a school it's gone to by special forces, by CIA, by National Security Agency people. I mean, and he wrote this letter and came out publicly, and the Air Force initially came down on him with both feet. He kind of disappeared, and they said immediate disciplinary action. And he did the right thing. He said, great, I want a public court-martial. And the last public statement that anybody has seen was that the matter had been resolved and he was going to quietly retire. So we don't know where he is. I think he was transferred, might have been transferred to the Rocky Mountain region, maybe Colorado.
All right, well, it's really tragic, but I certainly respect him for having the courage to come out, but I'm sure they've also threatened his pension if he ever, of course, opens his mouth or tells the truth about what's going on, which they can't do legally. But then when you stop and think of the implications of what happened, I mean, allowing 3,000 Americans to die, that is a pretty serious criminal thing. And so they're not going to, of course, let anything get in the way. And the last thing they would want is for the American people to suspect that they had prior knowledge of what was going to happen and that somebody intentionally grounded the planes that morning. Have you been able to get anybody who would come forward and say that the orders were actually given not to allow any planes in the air?
No, but I think we're getting close to that. There is getting to be, from various sources, a great deal of questioning on what happened with the scrambling of fighters that should have been automatic on 9/11. And those inconsistencies are lingering. We have a pretty weak and ineffective independent commission appointed by President Bush that's trying to answer some questions which, the members themselves, like Thomas Keene, have business dealings and investments in oil companies that work with the Bin Laden family. So we shouldn't expect much, but these guys have tried to ask some questions, and the White House has denied them all security clearances even, and they've withheld documents. But these guys have actually started to ask questions about the fighters, and in my book, I will have, it's about now, a 6-foot-long flowchart that lays out from documented footnoted sources what was known when on the morning of 9/11 and what the response should have been, and actually what the response was in 56 separate occasions in the year before 9/11 and what actually happened. And we come to one central point of focus, which is the National Hijack Coordinator at the FAA, who had really the trigger-pulling responsibility to scramble fighters in all four of the hijack situations, and this is the guy that failed to act. So we see, like in the FBI, a conspiracy like this does not require thousands of people. It only requires a couple of dozen key people in key situations who know little pieces of the puzzle.
No, we're going to have to just we're back in just a moment. All right, fine. Well, we have certainly our listeners up there in the great Northwest. We'll be back with this in just a moment or two. But right now, of course, our guest is Michael Rupert, and we're talking about 911 and certainly the fact that somebody gave orders that the fighter planes were not to be scrambled that morning. And there was an hour and 40 minutes from the time the first plane was hijacked until the third plane hit the Pentagon. And as Christian Breitweiser said in her testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee on the 18th of September of last year, why one of the planes actually did a loop-de-loop around the Pentagon to come in.
That was a great quote.
Right. And, of course, her testimony was totally censored by the controlled media. It is available on my website in my October newsletter. That's October last year. You can get Tristan Breitweiser's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee, and I have been told that they've actually classified some of the material that came out during the initial investigation. I haven't checked that out myself, but
yes, they have.
They actually have actually classified Kristen and some of the other testimony?
Not her testimony, but some of the stuff that was public knowledge well before has since been classified, and some of the stuff that was said in the public hearing has since been classified.
Now, well, you have to ask yourself why. I mean, if there's nothing to hide, why are they hiding it? Is it we don't want Muhammad Atta to find out? Or
yes. Or Osama bin Laden, wherever he is.
Right. Well, in fact, he could be dead for all we know. But they keep his image there because, of course, we have to have somebody to hate. Now, I'm not saying he is dead. In fact, I suspect he's not. But he could be dead. But, of course, all we know is, of course, what we're told by the media. And they want this mysterious figure to be out there, so we will have this figure to rally against. And, of course, we know, and we can have articles saying, during the Afghan war, where top officials were quoted as saying, we do not intend to take us out of Osama bin Laden. Our policy is Osama bin Laden last, not Osama bin Laden first, because if we took him out, how would we justify continuing the war?
That's right. Well, there's a lot of oil that has to be seized, and that's truly the bottom line is there.
Well, of course, when we control Iraq's oil, and we control Iran's oil, and we control Saudi Arabia's oil, we will control the major oil sources in the world.
Yes, but that oil is starting to run out, and that's what people have desperately got to understand. I just returned 2 days ago from Paris, France. I attended the second international conference of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, which had representatives from 20 countries. I'm talking government, high-ranking oil executives, automakers, economists, discussing the fact that peak oil is here now. In other words, all oil production follows a bell curve, and on the downslope of the bell curve, it's just like in your kitchen. If you want a can of beans out of the cupboard, you reach for the one that's closest to you. You don't go down to the basement, rummage around, or drive to the store, because that's a lot more expensive than just grabbing the one close by. Well, we've used all the close-by oil, and we're running down the production curve, which means that production is going to become ever more expensive, plus we have now outstripped the demand, or the ability of the planet to produce oil to satisfy demand, even while Chinese auto sales last year increased by 50%. In other words, we have way overshot, in terms of population and demand, the Earth's ability to produce oil. And we consume or burn 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy for every calorie of food.
We're going to be right back here. All right. Well, our special guest this evening is Michael Rupert, and we're just talking about the fact that the Earth is beginning to run out of oil. And, of course, one of the big things is this massive demand in China. China's beginning to buy more and more cars. Of course, they're not buying them from America. There are American corporations that are building them over in China. And, of course, none of the profits are ever going to come home because we tax them excessively high to discourage the profits from coming home and building the plants here. Because the real purpose of everything going on today is from each according to his ability to each according to their need. In other words, transferring the great wealth of America to the rest of the world as we build up the rest of the world in preparation for the New World Order, the New World Religion. But we can't let the American people know that we intend to impoverish them. So we keep talking about, of course, those wicked corporations, and we're going to do this and that. The other thing, but the real truth of the matter is we've actually encouraged them to move offshore, and of course many of them are quite willing to do that. We will tax them if they bring their money back here. We will give them a free ride if they keep their money and begin building up plants throughout the rest of the world. But in the process of doing that, as we mobilize the people of China, they're going to be consuming the oil. And of course, how long do they think we have before we run out of oil? What about the oil in the Caspian Basin? Is that going to another 10 or 20 years?
No, the Caspian oil basin oil has turned out to be a monstrous bust. When 9/11 happened, I and many others were saying Caspian oil is one of the motives. Now, it turns out, in fact, that there's a lot of natural gas in the Caspian Basin. Unfortunately, that does not do the U.S. any good because converting to liquid natural gas is not effective, and there aren't enough tankers to supply the U.S. But what they thought was 150, 200 billion barrels in the Caspian Basin has proven only over the last 2.5 years of drilling to be only about 40 billion barrels. They're hitting like about 12 dry holes at a cost of $10 to $40 million a well for every well that comes in wet. So what they're finding is isolated pockets, and so there's only, at the most, 40 billion barrels in the whole Caspian region, which is not enough to build pipelines to get the oil out. That means, of course, that the 25% of all the oil on the planet that's in Saudi Arabia, the 11% that's in Iraq, the 6% or so that's in Kuwait, becomes that much more important because there aren't any more large reservoirs.
How about Iran?
Iran is I think about the number six country, fourth or fifth country in terms of endowment. But believe it or not, Iran has already passed its peak of production. It's on the downslope. The last countries to peak will be Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq, Bahrain, and most of the other OPEC countries in the Middle East. Iran pumped most of its wealth out. The U.S., 48 states, including Alaska, actually peaked in production way back in 1970. Per capita energy consumption for the planet peaked in 1979. The U.S. is now importing over half of its oil. By the year 2020, we will be importing 70% of our oil, and by the year 2050, we will be importing 90%. Of our oil, and so will China. Now, we are 5% of the world's population using 25% of the world's energy. By the year 2020, 2030, the U.S. and China will be using probably 60% of all the oil that's produced. Now, if you do the math, what's left for India, Malaysia, Europe, the rest of the world?
Well, of course, if you impoverish the United States, that won't be so much of a problem. And the way that they're going, shipping our jobs, shipping our industry, shipping our white-collar industries overseas, we may not be quite as mobile by that time. Certainly, there is an organized effort to lower the living standards of the American people without telling the American people what they're up to.
Well, as a matter of fact, economists and researchers who look at peak oil predict that scenario, but they don't predict it just for the U.S. They predict it for the whole world. And we have actually seen that happen. The dreaded Council on Foreign Relations and its allied banks have written consistently that oil price spikes invariably lead to recession. And what they predict along the top of peak oil is that when supply becomes scarce, as it did recently, you get a big price spike, and then all of a sudden you have a major recession, people are laid off and stop buying oil, and then price eventually drops again. So you get this really dramatic jigsaw pattern until you go over the cliff and there's just not enough for anybody.
And then, of course, we see that Exxon, I think it's ExxonMobil or whatever it is, they got about $7 billion the first quarter profit. $12 billion in the banks yet. I'd like to have something like that. But anyway, we're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Mike Rupert, and then we're going to go to our good friend Theodora, who's calling in. We'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast, 464-8295. this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and right now, let's go to Theodore. Our guest, of course, is Michael Rupert, his website, Into the Wilderness. Theodore, how are you doing tonight?
Well, I'm good, and I'm real glad to hear Michael Rupert. I'm a longtime follower of your work, Michael, and haven't been able to see you live yet, so I'm always glad to hear you on the radio. I had a couple of questions.
Okay, fine.
The first one is around the...
I will translate them now. We'll have to get our engineer to get that fixed. Go ahead. Ask your question, Theodore.
Okay. The first question is around the theory that that no plane actually crashed into the Pentagon. I've heard some, theories both ways on that one, and I'm curious whether Michael has it.
All right, did you get the question, Michael? It was a really, do you feel that a plane crashed into the Pentagon, or was this something else?
Well, the answer is, like everybody else, has watched all those videos, and nobody has seen a plane in any of them. I have looked at a great deal of the research, and I kind of believe that no plane hit the Pentagon. However, I have not chosen to write about it for the simple reason that having watched that debate and also the debate about whether explosives were placed in the towers, I have watched arguments that have eaten up people's lives and produced absolutely no result in the real world, as I knew they wouldn't. Thierry Masson's book out of France really makes a great case for that, yet if you mention his name anywhere in Washington or in most of mainstream America, it's like you're espousing devil worship. So there are some battles that I choose not to fight because they are totally counterproductive.
And I think that's really very wise. Theodore, I will tell you, I did a little research. I actually tracked down two people who claim that they saw the airliner hit. Now, one of them was a priest who, of course, could be lying, but I don't think he was. The other was a fellow who has a website. And, of course, I had a friend who got six people who said that they actually saw a plane hit. But what they're doing is they're playing games with our minds. They're giving us, this is what they did with the Kennedy assassination. They're putting so much information out there. True or false doesn't really matter. What they want to do is get us all upset and arguing and expending all of our energy. Were there explosives in the Twin Towers or weren't there? Now, that isn't the issue. The issue is, why were there no fighter planes there that morning? Why were there only about 25% of the people on those planes who should have been on the planes? Why, when nine of those men, and we have the articles on this, were stopped on that morning, and nine of the hijackers were stopped and specifically questioned in airports across the country, and they knew we were on maximum alert because they knew the attack was coming. Why did they let those hijackers onto the planes if there was any question at all about there being a terrorist attack that morning? Do you have another question?
And my other question is kind of off topic, but it's something I'm deeply concerned about, and I'm wondering if Mr. Rupert is focusing any attention on it too, since as far as I'm concerned, our one way out of this is through elections. I mean, we can speak all the truth that we want, but if we haven't got the ability for fair elections to go in and overturn and vote out these people, we're lost.
Okay, now what's the question?
And let me finish.
I can hear you.
I'm very concerned about the touchscreen voting machines and the scamming of the elections that's already going on.
All right, fine. And good. You got the question there?
Anybody who has any faith in the American electoral process, I've got a bridge I want to sell you. I've got some life insurance I want to sell you. The election process is totally compromised. It was in 2000, but in the last midterm elections, we saw the appearance of this voting software, some of which is owned by Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, who won by an 83% landslide, happens to own major shares of all the voting machines in Nebraska.
I think the important thing is we need to demand paper ballots. At least we have paper ballots here in Santa Cruz, and I don't think that Mr. Bedell is going to change over.
Well, they're talking about it in 2005.
Well, boy,
let's
make a fuss about it because, how do you go back and find out if you've been robbed? I think we need to just talk about that.
What's worse is that right after the midterm elections, a U.S. district court handed down a ruling that the new election software is proprietary information, therefore not subject to inspection.
Well, then we have to demand paper ballots. That's the only thing we can do. Anything else, though?
Well, that's it, and I'm glad Mr. Rupert's on to that issue, because I feel like that's the red flag that, along with everything else, that we really have to pay attention to.
I'll be
so
talking about
you.
That in my book.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye, and our telephone number, if you're out there in the listening audience, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Theodore is absolutely right. We cannot trust electronic voting. In fact, the one thing we want, or I would love to get back to, is paper ballots that are actually counted in the precinct and then taken down and recounted at the courthouse, and we can check one against the other. Because anything as important as voting, you have to have everybody being checked, because I will tell you that we have working right in our local election department people who, if they're not communists, certainly would be if they were still carrying communist cards. And they're involved with this whole thing. They're not interested in fairness. They're interested in winning. We, of course, they have a perfect right to be there. We've just got to make sure that the process is done honestly. All across the country, the radical left are working, and I shouldn't say radical left, because there are a lot of good radical lefters. But let's put it this way. The people who want a fascist society are working to compromise the voting situation. And I share Theodore and certainly Michael's position on that. And I hope everybody out in the listening audience will make this a cause for crusading. Otherwise, there's no sense even bothering to go to the voting booth, because all you're doing is carrying out an act of frustration. It's not going to mean anything at all.
That's correct.
All right. Well, what are some of the other things that you'd like to talk about having to do with 911? What have you got at all into this flight school down in Florida that apparently had a tie into the CIA?
Well, no, that's been done by a colleague of mine, Daniel Hobson,
right,
who has actually done some fabulous work. His website's madcowprod.com, and he's uncovered some amazing information out of that. I have chosen to focus more on a national and international level, because that's where I find the weapons where the government can be discredited. I think most of my research was what pushed people like Bob Graham back into a corner where they had to go into a damage control mode over the stuff that was known about the attacks before they occurred. And I think where I've had some of the biggest success too post 9/11 is in the area of biological warfare research. We've published many articles on that. And also in actually predicting where things were going to go. We wrote a story 9 months ago that said as soon as Iraq was occupied, the Saudi government would go unstable and the U.S. would move over a period of time by fomenting the uprisings in Saudi Arabia to partition the country and to separate the oil that's in the eastern part of the country from Mecca and Medina, which are in the western part of the country. We would basically have the Arab Republic of Aramco with the oil and the Arab Republic of Islam with Mecca and Medina. And that sure is coming to pass. And we've also predicted the major uprisings in West Africa. And lo and behold, that's starting to happen too.
Now, of course, are you speaking where? Nigeria?
Nigeria. We'll see it also in Sierra Leone, Angola, the Congo, all throughout that region, sub-Saharan Africa, just south of Morocco. Kerr McGee has just made major investments along with the great law firm of Baker Potts, James Baker. And what's important about Western Africa is several things. Number one is it takes 6 weeks for gasoline or oil from Iraq to reach an American gas tank. It takes 2 weeks for oil from Nigeria to reach an American gas tank. The country is much less susceptible to any kind of attacks because a lot of its production is offshore. And the U.S. Navy, of course, can get right there on the west coast of Africa. But even more importantly, there will be no immediate bonanza from Iraq. The Iraqi infrastructure is toast. I mean, it's just all beaten up. Their peak production was 3.5 million barrels a day in 1990, right before the Gulf War. They were at 2 million barrels a day roughly before we invaded. They're down to less than 1 million barrels a day now. And all the best oil experts are clear that it's going to take 3 years and roughly $5 billion to get Iraq back up to 3.5 billion barrels a day. So what we need, or what the world economy needs, is what's called a swing producer, something that's able to, a country that's able to increase production. and there are very, very few of them. Saudi Arabia is strapped. Everybody else is producing to maximum, and they're still not meeting demand. But Nigeria could fill that role for a short period. They only have roughly, maybe 25 billion barrels of oil, which may sound like a lot, but bear in mind the world uses a billion barrels of oil every 12 days. So that doesn't last long. But what Nigeria can do is increase by 500,000 to 1 million barrels a day to control the price and to flood U.S. markets to help the U.S. economy. And that's why it's critical that we go first to West Africa, probably Saudi Arabia and West Africa, but then also ultimately to Colombia.
Well, you know, the interesting thing as far as Nigeria is concerned is that Saudi Arabia has been investing a lot of money there and inflaming the Islamic population. About, 20-30% of the population is Islamic. I don't have the exact figures with me, but certainly there is a small group that is Islamic. And, of course, but Saudi has been building the mosques and trying to get them, commit all sorts of acts of terrorism there. And, of course, this is a real problem for Nigeria. The people there just want to live in peace and be left alone. But you got all these radical al-Qaeda elements there working there, inflaming the Muslim population, who probably would like to live in peace. They're not going to give them an opportunity to. And the only way you're going to stop this is to cut off the funds from Saudi Arabia.
That's part of it. But al-Qaeda doesn't do anything unless CIA wants it to. Now, people will hear that incorrectly and say, oh, come on, the al-Qaeda guys don't work for the CIA. And I can guarantee you that they don't think that they do. In the history of covert operations that I've studied for 25 years, and I'm kind of recognized as something of an expert on this, the way intelligence services run assets, and we'll call al-Qaeda an asset, is one of the most sought-after ways is that the asset has no idea who's running them. Osama bin Laden, I think, most certainly knows, and I think maybe one or two of his lieutenants know, that they're serving CIA and financial interests because his family, from which he was never estranged, is a multi-billion dollar business operation. They run the Bin Laden Group, and they operate 54, I think it is, satellites in space, handling the cell phone and satellite data transmissions. They're an extremely powerful family. So al-Qaeda will turn up conveniently wherever the U.S. needs an enemy to seize the oil field.
Well, and then, of course, how will we use that in Nigeria? Will we, of course, justify our interference in there? Because certainly the al-Qaeda is destabilizing that. Well, what are your thoughts on Nigeria?
It's already happened. Over the last month and a half, 2 months, there were a series of rebel uprisings, shells and mobiles, the offshore platform, which is right off the coast of the Niger Delta, where they do a lot of the storage, all the pipelines run there, it's where the tankers filled up, was seized by rebels, and the U.S. Government shipped 7 gunboats on an emergency basis to the Nigerian Navy, and this happened probably 3-4 weeks ago.
No, I hadn't heard that, so that's an interesting slant on that. So, well, I'm so glad that to get that clarified, because I've been very concerned about the al-Qaeda's effort to destabilize that. What you're suggesting is they're destabilizing it so we can justify interfering.
That's exactly right, and they will not destabilize anything that we don't want to see. That's exactly what's happening in Saudi Arabia and in Morocco. The bombings in Morocco happened just a matter of hours after I published a story saying that West Africa was next, and then the bombings hit West Africa. And that was like clockwork. And I have had a CIA source tell me for some time, and whether it's true or not doesn't make a difference. The point is that's what he wants people to think. He's been telling me for more than a year that Osama bin Laden is alive and well and living in Freeport, Sierra Leone, on the coast of West Africa. And I even have a picture on my website of a youth in Freeport wearing an Osama bin Laden T-shirt.
Well, I guess I wonder where Saddam Hussein is. I know that Saddam Hussein at one time was very, very close to the CIA. But of course, we American people find that so difficult to believe that we would have supported this wicked, wicked, wicked Saddam Hussein, you know, after he had tortured and killed so many people, and yet we backed him all during the 1980s, and there's a great deal to suggest that he was working with, or certainly with the support of our government back in the 1960s. But there's no question he was working for us, or with us, all during the 1980s. And yet the American people find that so difficult to believe.
Well, it's absolutely true. I kind of suspect that Saddam is in Russia.
Could very well be. Well, anyway, we have somebody coming on the line here, and we'll have them on in just a moment. In fact, we'll go ahead and pick them up right now. This is Willie. Is this Willie we have?
Yeah.
Where are you calling from?
Washington State.
Okay, what part of Washington?
Kennewick.
Okay, go ahead. Do you have a question or comment?
I was wondering if you saw the interview with Manuel Noriega on, I think it was either 2020 or 60 Minutes, right after they arrested him.
No, I don't recall.
I couldn't hear a word.
He wondered if we'd seen the interview with Manuel Noriega. This would be 4 or 5 years ago, I suppose, right after he was arrested, you know, after we invaded Panama. What was the point you wanted to make, Willie?
You ever hear of the game 6 Degrees of Separation from Kevin Bacon?
No, what was the point?
So you take Kevin Bacon and add different actors that he played with to come back to Kevin Bacon. I do that with George Bush.
I know, but what's the point? Because, you see, Michael can't hear what you're saying.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, go ahead. What was the point?
I was just asking you.
Okay, fine. Well, no, I don't know, but I have no question at all that, and Michael, I'll let you comment on this, but the question had to do with Noriega. Noriega was a CIA asset, mm-hmm. For one reason or other. He was taking too much money, or thought he was working independently, and they just went down there and captured him and killed a lot of people in the process. But, of course, Noriega was working with the CIA, bringing drugs into the country. Isn't that true, Michael?
Well, yes, he was for a long period of time. But what Noriega's great crime was, his crime had two aspects. Number one, he had so much money that he decided that he could be independent. And he became very expendable at the point when, during the Contra War in 1987, he decided to start the Contadora peace process, which was trying to bring an end to the Contra War, which was basically the same mistake, one of the mistakes made by the Shah of Iran, who had become so wealthy thanks to U.S. influence that he got too big for his britches, and Noriega kind of dug his own grave.
Sure. Okay, fine. Anything else, Willie?
Yeah, on that interview, he actually was saying that he was bringing the drugs in, and that George Bush wanted him to bring more drugs in, and he was talking about that was more than he was willing to do, and that's why the war on drugs.
Okay, and I'll tell you, thanks very much, Willie, and of course what Willie was saying that during the interview, which I didn't see, but that Noriega admitted he was bringing in drugs, but that George Bush had wanted to bring in more drugs, and he thought he didn't want to do that. I have no question at all that Mr. Bush, President George Herbert Walker Bush, former director of the CIA, was deeply involved in drugs. In fact, I talked to a man, his name was Terry Reed, who was actually hired, a man was L.T. Brown, who was actually hired to kill Terry Reed, and of course Terry Reed had written a book called Compromised Bush, Clinton, and the drugs at MENA Airport. So obviously George Bush was a little unhappy that anybody would write a book about his involvement in drugs. And if he was involved in drugs, would we be surprised at all that Richard Armitage, who is presently the deputy secretary of state under Colin Powell, that Richard Armitage had been named at least a decade ago as being the major conduit for heroin from the Golden Triangle into the United States?
All those guys are back in power right now. You have Dick Armitage, you have Elliot Abrams, you have John Negroponte, you have John Poindexter, for God's sake. He's a convicted felon who was running the Office of Total Information Awareness, which is a database based upon the Promise software, which will give the government the ability to merge any individual's medical records, driving license records, bank records, educational records, you name it, all into one database, and find out everything about you at the drop of a hat. And that's, of course, a major invasion of privacy, grossly unconstitutional. But all these Iran-Contra felons are back in office now. The only one who's not back is Oliver North. He's out doing shows for Fox.
And, of course, Bill Lepp is a great Christian patriot. And, of course, I know one of my friends. We went to a meeting, and Oliver was there, along with two or three really thuggy-looking bodyguards. And one of my friends went up to him and said, you know, you and Bo Greitz ought to get together, you know, and Oliver North's remark was, I'm not involved in drugs. And then he went on to say, my closest friend is Richard Armitage. And he told my friend that. I'll never forget it. Richard Armitage, apparently they both had gone to, I guess he would have gone to the Naval Academy because he's a Marine. But so anyway, of course, you begin to, you have to have a program to understand who the players are. And the average person finds it so difficult to believe that our Christian administration would, of course, put somebody in like Richard Armitage, who is certainly, there's much evidence that he's been involved in drug smuggling with the CIA for years. And, of course, all I can say is I just think that somebody ought to get to the president and let him know what's really going on.
No, I think the president already knows what's going on. He's part of it.
Well, let's get into some of what are some of the other things that you really think need to be brought out to our listeners.
One of the things that's most important to understand is that the government, the way it's operating now, is nothing more than a franchise for private corporations. We have $3.3 trillion missing out of the Pentagon, out of their budgets from the fiscal years of 2000-2001. $3.3 trillion, and now somebody will come back and say, well, how can that be? The Pentagon budget's only $486 billion a year. And I come back and say, yes, but you forget that the Pentagon manages the pensions for 3 million military personnel, another 1.8 million civilian employees. It owns real estate, it operates leases, and it has, when its weapon systems are allocated over a 10-year period, that money is moved in a lump sum and only added to the budget once a year. Now, you have two companies that do the data processing for the financial bookkeeping systems of almost every agency of the U.S. government, including the Pentagon, HUD, Department of Justice. And those firms are Lockheed Martin, Lynn Cheney, the vice president's wife, was formerly on the board of directors until he took office, and a firm called DynCorp, D-Y-N-C-O-R-P, which is one of the dirtiest firms you can ever imagine. And DynCorp has a very interesting history. When it was founded and headed by a man named Herbert Pug Whitaker, who came out of Harvard, or the Harvard Endowment, which made about $16 billion, or grew by $16 billion under Bill Clinton. But Herbert Pug Whitaker was also the chairman of the Enron Finance Committee, who signed off on all the bookkeeping and claimed ignorance afterwards. DynCorp does a multitude of things, but DynCorp employees were caught and filmed running a child sex slave ring in Bosnia. They have contracts all over the world with the military to supply them with warehousing and other facilities and certain investigative services and so on and so forth. And DynCorp employees were running child prostitution rings, and they had sex slaves as young as 8 years old in Bosnia. The Army came up with a report on that. They're spraying herbicides that are killing people all over the southern part of Colombia. They're not spraying coca crops. They're spraying farm crops and people. There are no birds or butterflies left anywhere in southern Colombia. And DynCorp, this company which has supervised the looting of $3 trillion out of the Treasury, has just been given the contract to run the policing and the court system in Iraq.
Well, now, of course, isn't DynCorp really a CIA front?
Well, it's more than a CIA front. It's a money front. I mean, the CIA is Wall Street. The CIA has always represented Wall Street interests. And DynCorp is very much the same way. Former CIA Director James Woolsey has a financial stake in DynCorp. But DynCorp is a very major player. And yet this is part of the criminal apparatus that's running the entire U.S. government right now.
Well, I think that people pretty ought to check out what Michael is saying. I've been reading about DynCorp elsewhere, and, of course, the fact it was running sex slaves in Bosnia. And, of course, Michael is just confirming what we've heard elsewhere. Let's go to Rose, who's calling from New York. Rose, you have a question or comment?
Yes, a short comment and a question, but I'll get the question first. You may be off topic now because you've moved on since I got off the Internet. On the oil issue, I've known for a long time and heard from people in the oil industry and people who live around oil rigs that we've been for years capping every well we find in the oil.
All right, so let me ask Michael about that. Rose is saying that we have actually capped some of our oil wells here in the United States. Have you heard that sort of thing?
Not true. Absolutely not true. If oil wells are capped, it's because they aren't producing. Understand this, that an oil well is not dry when it runs out of oil. An oil well is dry when it takes more energy to produce a barrel of oil than you get from burning the barrel of oil. One of the things that we saw at this conference that I just came back from in Paris, France, was a BBC, an excellent BBC documentary that went around places in Texas that showed these kneeling donkey wells that are pumping like crazy and only producing 7 barrels of oil a day. And when they produce 5 barrels of oil a day, the owners have to shut them down because it takes more electricity. It takes 5 barrels of oil worth of electricity to run the pumps.
Well, now, what about what we've heard is that there's a lot of natural gas up on the North Slope, and yet, of course, they won't allow them to build a pipeline to bring it down.
No, not true. It's a drop in the bucket. American consumption. The Vice President's National Energy Policy Development Group, Dick Cheney's secret task force, called for the construction of 1,900 new natural gas-powered power-generating stations over the next 15 years. In a dissenting report filed at the Council on Foreign Relations and through the James Baker Institute, one of President Bush's closest energy advisors, who I just interviewed in Paris, said there is no way these plants are going to be built because there will be no return on investment. That means there's no gas because demand is a given. There are some loose gas deposits in Alaska, and people see where they've got a little flame burning. That is a purely mechanical function of having to relieve some pressure off of a vent because they don't want to spend the money necessary to cap it and seal it and everything else. The natural gas figures for the United States are, in fact, much, much worse than the oil figures are, and that's part of what contributed. We've seen natural gas prices in the last year go up 400%. There's a reason for that. They're drilling new wells in Texas at the rate of 1,600 new wells a year, and the wells are going dry after a year, meaning the big reserves have been found. Now, what's in the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve is enough to run the entire United States for about 2 months.
All right. Anything else you'd like to ask?
Yes. And what about the Israel that is the oil that is supposedly found in Israel?
Do you know anything about that? Many people believe there's oil in Israel or down by the Dead Sea. Have you heard anything about that?
There is no oil in Israel.
All right, fine. And I've always been a little concerned, Rose, that that was a financial scam to get a lot of gullible Christians to invest, but I don't know for certain. Anyway, thanks very much for calling. We're just about out of time.
Okay.
Okay, and you can listen, call the next hour if you'd like to, okay?
Sure.
Bye-bye. And, of course, this is the time when we're going to have to sort of say goodbye to our listeners up in the Great Northwest. And, of course, we want to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We're dependent on you to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours a day on shortwave, internet, radio stations, and, of course, by the miracle of just regular old radio. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WARM. And, of course, pray for America. Pray for revival. But please remember to pray for our Radio Liberty and our provision and protection. And so to the listeners up in the Great Northwest, we'll be back again tomorrow evening. Until then, may the Lord be with you. And for our regular listeners, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And Chris just got a call, the email yesterday from somebody over in Japan who's listening to us on a regular basis. And we have people, of course, in the South Pacific and New Zealand and Australia. People over in Europe are listening. Certainly lots of listeners up in Canada. So it's exciting to realize that through the miracle of the Internet, we can reach an awful lot of people, as well as on our regular radio stations. But right now, of course, we want to introduce our very, very special guest. His name is Michael Rupert. His website is From the Wilderness. Michael, thanks very much for being with us this second hour.
Thank you so much, Dan. It's good to be with you.
All right, fine. Well, now, what are we going to talk about this second hour? What are the issues that, the burning issues you'd like to bring to our people? During the first hour, we talked about the oil situation, that we're running out of the oil, that the world is running out of oil. And mm-hmm. But why aren't we trying to develop some of the other alternative energy sources?
That's a great question.
All right, fine. So why don't you give us your take on that?
Well, I'm just preparing a report on that right now, but we've been looking at that for almost 2 years. And first of all, there's a great deal of bad information there about what alternative energy sources can do. There is not going to be any solution to running out of oil that will enable the world to live the way that it's living now, and especially the industrialized nations to live the way that they're living now. There is no replacement for oil. Now, hydrogen is a classic case in point that's being hyped by a lot of demagogues out there who are putting out really bad information on hydrogen. And here's a case in point why. One of the primary questions to ask of energy, of any alternative energy source, is what's the net energy, or what's the energy returned on energy invested? Do you know how they're making commercial hydrogen now? They're using natural gas to make it. They're treating natural gas with steam. This is called brown hydrogen, in a process called methane reduction, to separate hydrogen atoms. And it takes more energy to separate the hydrogen than you get from burning it. Did you know that it takes 3,000 gallons of gaseous hydrogen to provide the energy that equals 1 gallon of gasoline? If you go to compressed hydrogen, you get a much better result. You get about a ratio of 20 to 30 to 1 with compressed hydrogen. But the problem is there, you run the risk of becoming the Hindenburg in a traffic accident. Liquid hydrogen is much better, but there are no fuel systems anywhere capable of handling a liquid that's 270-some degrees below zero Fahrenheit. People talk about electrolysis to make hydrogen. Right now it takes 1.3 kilowatt hours of electricity, which comes from burning natural gas, to produce 1 kilowatt hour of hydrogen. There is no commercially viable hydrogen production facility that will be of any use for about 20 to 30 years. Now, the White House has not only admitted this, but in Paris, one of the top guys from Daimler Chrysler, they understand what the oil situation is, and they say, hydrogen is not commercially viable. It's never going to replace the internal combustion engine. There are many questions you have to ask, but one of the key ones is about the feedstock. So some people say use renewables like windmills or solar to make hydrogen. Well, that's fine. Somebody asked the question about how many windmills it would take to produce enough hydrogen to run the 600 million automobiles that are on the planets right now. And the answer was that it would take enough windmills to cover approximately one-third of the Earth's surface. Now, who's going to pay for those? And where are they going to come from? Because the windmills are largely made from plastic. And guess what plastic is made of? Oil. See, these are the questions people have to ask. All commercial fertilizers are made from ammonia, and all ammonia comes from natural gas. And fertilizer prices are about to go through the roof, just as natural gas prices are about to go up. I think this summer we're going to have serious brownouts. So there are many things that we can do that will soften the blow, but there is nothing that will replace what hydrocarbon energy does for human civilization right now.
Well, what do we have? Do we have another 20, 30 years of hydrocarbons available?
Yeah, well, this is the one thing that people need to understand. It's not like a tap that turns off. Under the best of circumstances, the best experts in the world, and I was just with them in Paris. I mean, these are guys, Dr. Colin Campbell had been the chief geologist for British Petroleum before he retired. Jean Laherrere had been the chief discovery manager for Total Fina Elf. We have professors. And these are people who know, and incredible science behind this. God endowed the planet with about 2 trillion barrels of conventional, what we call conventional oil. We have used more than 1 trillion barrels. That means there's less than half left, meaning we're starting the downslope of the bell curve. Under the best of circumstances, the world using a billion barrels every 12 days, there is at most at present demand level 30 to 34 years of oil left.
But of course, this would destroy the automotive industry. It would destroy really the whole industrialized capacity of our nation if we were to run out of oil.
But demand is going through the roof. Demand is not going to stay static. Population is exploding. Chinese car sales went up 50% last year. They went up about 30% in Malaysia. And the U.S. economy is based upon selling consumer goods that need either automobiles or electricity or plastics to run. So we're on the horns of a dilemma. This is a crisis that cannot be postponed or evaded. It's here now. But going down the slope, every barrel of oil becomes more expensive and harder to obtain. A lot of people have raved or said, oh, the solution's in the Canadian tar sands. Well, I've got a story up on my website. It's a free story at fromthewilderness.com that's from oil drilling research that shows that Canadian tar sands oil is an absolute abysmal failure. The reason why is it requires 3 barrels of fresh water to produce 1 barrel of oil and so much natural gas, because what they do is they literally strip mine the tar sands. Then they boil water and steam wash it under pressure. Well, they cook the water with natural gas. Canada's running out. Under NAFTA and the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, Canadians are about to become very upset because they have lost their right to keep their natural gas for themselves. The United States now has the right to take Canada's natural gas to heat, to run our air conditioners or heat us before the Canadians get to use it. So what the Canadians are now contemplating, is, this is absurd thinking, is building a nuclear reactor to generate the steam to wash the tar sands.
Now, right now, of course, what about the coal that we have, massive supplies of coal here in the United States?
Okay. Coal will not run any vehicle on the road. Period. You can make synthetic fuels out of coal. Yes, you can use bitumen. But there you have, again, a negative return on energy. You will have to invest more British thermal units, or joules, J-O-U-L-E-S, of energy to turn that in. Hitler had synthetic fuel during the Second World War. It didn't save him because it cost him more in terms of electricity and gas than he got out of the oil produced. The short-term solutions to the energy crisis and peak oil, where everybody will panic, because we should have started these infrastructure changes 20, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when the predictions were first made, the world will panic and fall back on coal and nuclear. Now, coal, of course, has some very costly environmental prices attached to it.
What about nuclear?
Nuclear, well, first of all, there's not enough uranium to build enough reactors to run the whole planet on nuclear. Secondly, the cost is exorbitant. I mean, nuclear reactors are extremely expensive to build with a lag time of about 10 to 12 years.
That's because of all the environmental restrictions and regulations. And, you know, rather than, I know the one here they had at Mount Diablo, you know, they could have built it in 3 years. I think it took them about 20, simply because every time they tried to do anything, the environmentalists attacked them, vilified them, demanded more environmental studies, and the price went from about 400 met in up to, I think, at 3 or 4 billion.
I can guarantee you that nuclear will be a partial solution upon which the world will fall back, whether you like nuclear or not. It's one that's there. The French are already making that decision because they know what's coming, and they're actually a step or two ahead. But nuclear will not replace it. Now, remember, all fertilizers and pesticides come from oil. Nuclear is not going to solve that problem. Before mankind started using oil, the planet could support a population of 2 billion people. We currently have 6.5 billion people. By the year 2070, there will be 9 billion people on this planet, but no oil. Now, 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy for every calorie of food on the planet. Do the math. There's going to be rampant starvation. And the Bush administration knows this. I've got a detailed interview from this exclusive conference from one of his closest energy advisors that says the Bush administration knows all of this.
Well, now, what about the use of biological warfare to thin out, to cull the population? There are people who are planning on this sort of thing, at least that's
absolutely
my opinion. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. We just posted a huge investigation of SARS, which has some very specific indicators showing that there is evidence of biological weapons research behind the SARS virus, which has actually several different forms, and we don't know what they all are. But let's go back and talk about money, which I know is one of your favorite subjects. If we talk about the Federal Reserve, fractional reserve banking, if we talk about compound interest, if we talk about quote-unquote capitalism as we know it today, which is not capitalism like you or I would practice it, it is based upon infinite growth. A debt-based economy, it's like a pyramid scheme. It can only be sustained by infinite growth.
It's sort of like a Ponzi scheme, really.
Exactly. But if you look at, take out a $20 bill and look at it, what does that money represent? It represents the ability to do work, which is energy. I mean, if there's no electricity, if there's no car to drive, if there's nothing to buy because it wasn't made, if there's no food, your money doesn't do a doggone thing for you. But we are living in a world of finite energy. And the infinite money demands of capitalism is colliding head-on with finite energy resources. That's the bottom line. We have to change the way that money works. There was an incredible prophet by the name of M. King Hubbard, who was an oil expert who developed what's called Hubbard's Curve, which he published like in 1950, I think it was, or 60, which predicted exactly what's happening now. And everybody said, ah, you're crazy. Well, now he's being proven true. He said that the U.S. oil production would peak in 1970. It did. He said oil production always peaks about 30 to 40 years after discoveries peaked, and we are now burning 4 barrels of oil for every new barrel that we discover. And according to the curve, in 5 years, we'll be burning 6 barrels for every barrel we discover. In 10 years, we'll be burning 10 barrels for every barrel we discover. That's what peak oil means. Now, Hubbard said that you must change the definition of money. In order for money to work rationally in the world, it must be tied to energy. And that's absolute good sense, which would mean literally inverting the financial model. And Catherine Fitz, my dear friend, says we have to swap debt for equity, and we have to create neighborhood place-based stock corporations where the wealth generates from the bottom up rather than the top down.
Well, now, what about the possibility of offshore drilling here along the California coast? This has certainly been locked up. There are all sorts of rules and regulations, but when push comes to shove, I think they're going to simply say, forget it, this is what we're going to do, when the time is right, of course. Is there an adequate supply of oil here to keep it going for a time?
When push comes to shove, I'm sure they'll drill everywhere the market will sustain it. But, you know, 25% of all the oil in the world is in Saudi Arabia, 11% is in Iraq, 7% is in Kuwait, 4 to 5% in Iran. You know, there is a negligible percentage. The U.S. has nothing left. There may be 500,000 barrels or 500,000,000 barrels down there, but, you know, the world uses 1 billion barrels every 12 days. There is nothing left. There are no significant deposits left to find. People talk about deep shore. We had people at the Paris conference from the oil company saying, now, wait a minute. We get a dry hole one out of every 6 wells. Now, to drill a deep well hole that's below 500 meters of water, on the average costs us $50 million. So you're asking us to spend $200 million before we get one well? You see what, that's what the rationale is.
Sure. Well, of course, it has to be cost effective, and that's going to be the big thing.
Well,
so,
you know, all these scenarios have been discussed and looked at in depth, and the 2 days that I just spent in Paris absolutely confirmed the worst suspicions, which are getting worse by the moment. To have a guy like Matt Simmons of Simmons & Company in Houston, a friend of Bush, speak at this conference by satellite hookup and put it as bluntly as he did was telling. And this is what's driving the Bush administration and the whole world right now.
Well, now, will you have a report on your website on this whole meeting that you attended?
I'm in the middle of writing it right now. I stopped writing it to do this show with you, and I'll be finishing it tonight. It should be up tomorrow.
All right, fine. I think this is really so vastly important. Now, were the people from the CFR there, the people who really run things behind the scenes, this is basically what they've been planning?
Well,
anticipating, I should say?
Yeah, it's definitely what they've been anticipating. There's no question about that. I mean, you and I could both clearly, Stan, I'm sure you and I would have no problem envisioning Henry Kissinger sitting back in his chair going, the problem is not that there's too little oil, the problem is just that there are too many people.
Right.
You know, we could see that. And that, unfortunately, seems to be what they backed themselves, the corner they backed themselves into, because the financial markets can't admit it. Because the financial markets would collapse, even though they're starting to, they've been doing that since 2000 anyway. The politicians can't admit it because they won't get reelected, and there is this horrible denial in the human race that says somehow God's going to sanction everything that we do. I mean, my personal belief is that God put us on this planet with free will and asked us to grow up, and we haven't done that very well.
No, I'm sure not, and this may very well be part of his calling us to judgment when this whole infrastructure of our society begins to crumble. So, of course, if indeed, as you say, we're running out of oil, of course, this has been known for some time. This probably was one of the reasons behind this decision made many years ago, at least 5 to 6 years ago, to invade Iraq. And this certainly has nothing to do with the fact that Saddam Hussein is a wicked man, which he is, but then, of course, he was a wicked man that we consistently supported. And it certainly doesn't have anything to do with the belief that he had weapons of mass destruction that threatened us, because obviously he wouldn't use them for fear of massive retaliation, and they were all moved over to Syria anyway. So
wrong, yeah.
So basically, of course, but they had to have something to tell the American people, because they feel the American people just aren't smart enough to know the truth, and these people of superior intelligence know what's best for us and for the world.
That's another problem, is that these guys do think that they know best, and they don't. And one of the, I've been having a lot of dialogue with people on the on the so-called progressive left, but now people are coming around to this. It doesn't make any difference what you are. If you're in a boat that's sinking, your politics are irrelevant. And people have been asking many questions, especially about these alternative energy resources, and they haven't done the science, and they don't know the right questions to ask. And as they come around to a conclusion, I always ask one question. I said, do you think that you're ever going to see a hydrogen-powered M1 Abrams tank? Do you ever think you're going to see an F-16 fighter that runs on chicken grease or leftover vegetable oil? The answer is no. The answer is the only thing that gives a military empire its power is hydrocarbon energy. And the only way that the United States can maintain its role as an empire is through global population reduction, because in a world that's populated by 2 billion people, there is enough oil to sustain a U.S. military empire for maybe another 5-6 decades.
Well, of course, the thing is, how are they going to kill off hundreds of millions of people? And that's a terrible, terrible thing to say. But I really believe there's a plan to do that. Certainly, Jacques Cousteau suggested we were going to have to kill 350,000 people a day, and that is in the UNESCO Courier in November of 1990. 91, and you read Bertrand Russell, he talks about the importance of a black death sweeping throughout civilization every generation. And then, of course, we wouldn't have to worry about abortion or war, because neither one of those are really effective. But that comes from his book, The Impact of Science on Society, and so many of the other statements that have been made by these people who look at the world differently, who have no real compassion for human beings or human suffering, are the Henry Kissingers of the world. So we know that there is a population control agenda, and of course my fear is they have been working for many years on these biological warfare units, agents, and I fear that they're going to release them on the world.
Well, I think some may have already been. We broke a series of stories last year, actually starting in 2001, about the very mysterious deaths of as many as 15 world-class microbiologists.
Is that story up on your website? I'd like to actually check their names, because I have copies of the special virus cancer project, the government CIA project, going back to about 1961-62, and it has listed the names of all the people there, and I would just like to know how many of the people who died mysteriously actually were from that CIA program to create these new and terrible diseases.
What you would do, Stan, is most of the stories on my website are free. You would go to the left side of the website at FromTheWilderness.com and look for the heading, The World Since 9/11. And you click on that page, and I have it broken down into categories, and go to the biowarfare categories. You'll find all the stories on the dead microbiologists.
All right, fine.
What we found was that in looking at SARS, I had an expert medical researcher who's been used by major papers like the Washington Times and New York Times. I had her go through the backgrounds of these 15, as many as 15, but in particular 7 or 8 very key microbiologists who had biowarfare connections and DNA sequencing, and break down their specialties. And she said, oh my God, and it fit a theory which I had postulated about a year ago, that these guys were killed because they had been working on something that was very secret and compartmentalized, but that when a particular disease appeared, they would recognize that they had had a role in creating it. And as it turns out, some of the people involved did indeed have research specialties, like Don Wiley, Benito Kay, and a few others, with coronaviruses related to SARS. Some had worked with swine flu, some had worked with the Spanish flu, which are all cousins of SARS. And SARS, we know, is a mutated virus, which they haven't really identified and haven't really explained where it came from. So this was very significant. And we saw in a report that I published about, I guess it was about 2 weeks ago now, a 21-page investigation conducted by myself and Wayne Madsen, a former naval officer at the National Security Agency, which highlighted the CIA's bioweapons research, and which also pointed out that on the same day that we got our first public reports of SARS, another mysterious disease, not SARS, also appeared in Cambodia. Now, what are the odds of two genetically mutated diseases appearing at exactly the same time in close proximity to each other? Coincidentally, by the way, the first public report of SARS was the day we invaded Iraq.
Well, you know, the whole thing is really so incredible. You know, God gave us immunity. In other words, the human beings don't get animal viruses, and animals don't get human viruses. But this disease, of course, is apparently found in civet cats and dogs, and I've forgotten that, in 2 or 3 other species now, at least in 3 other species it's been found. Now, the question is, did it come from these other species to man, or did it go from man to the other species? And if it did, then there has to be something there that will allow it to jump the species. And, of course, what they do is they have these viruses, the Rouse virus, sarcoma virus, and the Mulroney sarcoma virus, and these all can be used to begin to move these, to break down these species barriers. This is the frightening thing, and most people don't understand. We have the ability to create new deadly diseases, and of course then they can be shifted from one species to another, and all the immunity that you and I would ordinarily have that would protect us from these diseases is simply gone. And I actually had one of the top biological researchers in the country. I'd talked to him, and he actually called me when the reports came out saying that the virus, the SARS virus, would last for 6 months, pardon me, for 30, at least for 24 hours on a plastic surface. And he said, that has to be, specifically biologically engineered. You just don't do that with viruses. So, I mean, there's so much pointing that this is a biologically created a virus. And people have to understand that this is what our tax money has been going on for many, many years.
Going back to the
special viral cancer project back in 1961. And, of course, you can, my latest newsletter is going to go into how they actually destroyed so many of the records because they did not want the American people to know what they'd been doing. This was back in 73.
Well, yeah, and we've documented much more recent stuff than that, interfacing between the CIA and the South African government. We have a two-part series by Kelly Ramirez tracing the history of research for gene-specific bioweapons. But what I'm really concerned with about SARS, and I'm sure you've noticed this, is that it has different diseases are being called SARS in different parts of the world. People can have a common cold or flu in one place, and they're locked up as SARS patients. There are slightly different SARS manifestations, and there's talk of mutations. And what my fear is that we have one disease, which may be just man-manipulated for the purpose of generating profits for pharmaceutical companies. Certainly, SARS has opened up China to the World Bank, which is now going to make loans to China. And Western medicine and Chinese prestige has suffered enormously as China was criticizing the U.S. invasion. But I think behind these other diseases that may be natural or may not be SARS at all, may be lurking this man-made disease. Now, we've heard a lot of medical doctors, and of course you are one, say that the flu seasons tend to run cyclically, that they die out in the spring and they come back in the winter, the same disease. That's what happened with the Spanish flu. So I'm very curious as to what we're going to see happen with SARS or some related disease this winter.
Well, you know, the frightening thing is that we actually sent scientists up into the Antarctic or up into the Arctic area to dig up, cadavers, and get the DNA of the Spanish flu so that, we would be able to recognize if it came around or we had it on hand. Why would you do something like that? I mean, you want it to be gone and never come back again. But obviously, this is a very deadly type of influenza, and they wanted that DNA on hand. Are they going to use that and release that again on the world? The last time it killed 20 to 40 million people. And, of course, could they make it much more deadly? I think we should all look into this and think very seriously about it because there really are evil and wicked people out there who have no respect for human life. And, of course, they've often said there are just too many people in the world.
Yeah, yeah. And these are very cynical people, too, who will... Alexander Solzhenitsyn said that men, in order to do evil, must first believe that what they're doing is good. And I think these people are so deluded that they have convinced themselves that they are the chosen, the anointed of God, et cetera, and placed in a position to make these kind of godlike decisions.
Well, I'm really very, very concerned. And, of course, the fact, we know we're being manipulated on this whole SARS issue because, at the most they've lost 700 or 800 people. That keeps changing all the time. But, we lose 30,000 people a year from influenza in the United States. So why? Because there are 700 or 800 people who die, over in the Far East. Most of them have been there, a few up in Canada. Why are we, five different articles day after day after day in the Wall Street Journal? Five separate articles day after day, three or four different articles in the New York Times day after day. I mean, I'm so tired of seeing people with those white masks on. Mm-hmm. They're playing games with our minds. And this is time that people really understood that this is an example of how you manipulate and create hysteria within a population.
Well, yeah, they're also conditioning us, of course, for all of the legal framework that has been put in place post 9/11 through the Patriot Act and Homeland Security now. President Bush issued a statement shortly after the SARS outbreak, actually it was an executive order, allowing the Public Health Service to forcibly quarantine anyone suspected of having SARS and to forcibly inject them or treat them, which is now possible under the Patriot Act. So we are being conditioned for those kinds of draconian measures.
Well, of course, the thing is that they have passed the model state Emergency Health Powers Act. It's called MEPA, Model Emergency Health Powers Act, and it's been introduced in every state in the union. Totally unnecessary, but obviously part of a long-range plan. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but I can assure you one thing, and that is whatever they're up to, when they're planning on major epidemics across America. So we better be informed, we better understand, we better prepare for very difficult times that lie ahead. We'll be right back here with our special guest and invite your calls here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Michael Rupert, and of course we're talking about the threat of biological warfare throughout the world and perhaps even here in the United States. And obviously they would not be passing in, the Model Emergency Health Powers Act in every state if this weren't part of some sort of a generalized plan, and we're not sure what it is, but they are anticipating that there's going to be a biological warfare attack here. And of course, they can actually, of course, force you to be vaccinated. If you do not go along with that, there are no exemptions. This, of course, application of draconian public health measures will be enforced against all diseases except the AIDS disease. Well, why don't we, enforce it against all diseases? Well, of course, if AIDS will not be included in this. In other words, they're going to let this epidemic continue to run its course. But they're going to go ahead and force the rest of us to be vaccinated, and they can take our property, they can take our weapons, they can take our cars, they can take our medicines. They can actually take everything we have in the name of a emergency health crisis. In other words, and all you need is, of course, for the governor to declare a health crisis, and all of these draconian laws, which are truly martial law, go into effect. Have you looked into this at all, Michael? Obviously, there's some reason they're planning something that we haven't been told about.
Oh, there's no question. We've written quite a bit about MEPA, and it appears that support for MEPA has dried up, but that doesn't hurt the agenda at all. What's happening is, of course, we're having state and local governments now in the worst budget crises of the last 60, 70 years, and many of the states, simply because of the budgetary drains of MEPA, have refused to pass it. It's spelled out. It has been passed in a few states, but what we find, and Ron Paul, the congressman from Texas, who is also a medical doctor, wrote about this, is that within the provisions of Homeland Security, everything that was included in MEPA is now combined, and when you that there are provisions in the Homeland Security bill that interact with the public health safety law, the federal law, which give everything that was in MEPA to the federal government. So they have the mechanism already in place. We don't have to worry about it being passed. It's already there. And this would include prosecution, criminal prosecution, on either misdemeanor or felony levels for refusing to be vaccinated, criminal prosecution for refusing to submit to state-ordered medical procedures, and the immediate confiscation of personal property and condemnation of whole neighborhoods or offices or homes that they deem to be contaminated without due process. You would get a hearing, I think, with no legal rights after about 2 weeks, and a decision would be handed down in 24 hours, and that's it. And the appeal process takes 4 or 5 years, but basically they can do whatever they want to.
But of course, the frightening thing was there'd be no compensation if they destroyed your property,
right,
saying it was contaminated. And I mean, we've already seen this fiasco with the smallpox. I mean, they got together a group of experts on smallpox, and of course the government was there. Boy, now you're going to back us when we want to vaccinate everybody. And they said no. There's really no need to do it. There's no smallpox in the world. There's no evidence of it. If it came up, we could vaccinate people very, very quickly. And the government said, oh, you've got to do something. So they agreed to 50,000 people, 50,000 healthcare workers to be vaccinated. And then, of course, the government, in its wisdom, totally ignored the experts and said, well, we're going to vaccinate 500,000 medical personnel, and then we're going to go up to 11 million personnel. And they started the program, and the people wouldn't go along with it. Really, actually increases my confidence in the American people that they refuse to go along despite all of the publicity and all of the hoopla that was put out by the government. And they sent out the vaccine to every community, and now this is the time to vaccinate all these healthcare workers, and they just wouldn't show up. So, well, I mean, there's understanding out there. Your efforts and the efforts of others are beginning to have an effect.
Well, that's a good sign, and I think that's one of the most effective things, that if the government ever tries to pull that, it will really call the emperor's new clothes into question and really weaken the legitimacy of the American empire. But we've had three people die as a result of the smallpox vaccinations. Many, many thousands just flat refusing to take it, both here and in Israel. I thought it was kind of interesting. But one provision of the Homeland Security bill really bothered me. There's already existing law that says the government can force people to take vaccines that have not been tested for efficacy. But within the Homeland Security bill, there's a provision holding harmless all the vaccine makers, so that if you drop dead, you can't sue the vaccine company.
And, of course, we have to ask what they're really thinking of, why they would want to give us a vaccine that had not been proven to be safe. And, of course, we remember the great faux pas that when they gave the Sabin vaccine back in late 1950s and early 1960s, and then they found out that there was a cancer virus in it, and it contaminated 90 million Americans. And then when they knew that, they continued giving it, and they've lied to the American people ever since then. Mm-hmm. A little wonder that many people really don't trust what the government says as far as vaccines and other things that they want to give us because they're there to help us. They're concerned about our health. Well, I think that when they've lied to me once, shame on them. If they lie to me twice and I let them get away with it, shame on me.
That's right.
Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest is Michael Rupert, who's on the front lines of this battle. And since the days when we first met Michael, when he was, of course, talking primarily about the CIA and drugs, well, a lot of things have changed. So his website is from the wilderness. Is that .org or .com?
.com.
.com. Well, you want to go there. And how can people get your newsletter?
Well, they can do it on the website. It's $35 a year for an online subscription. If you'd like to get both the online and have a snail mail copy to you every month, that's $50. You can do that both on the website or by calling. We have a toll-free number, which is 1-866-222-7693. That's 866-222-7693. We now have a ton of products up there, a lot of great books from great authors. We also have our Truth and Lies of 9/11 video, which is still ringing a lot of bells, and that's the one that was mentioned in our full-page ad. So a lot of information on the website.
All right, fine. And we've got a caller here, and let's see who it is. It is Charles, and Charles is calling from Watsonville. Hi, Charles. How are you doing?
Maybe next election we should vote with lead.
Okay. No, most important thing to do is to educate people, because, you know, if there were anything like that, the majority of the American people still solidly support the administration. And, of course, until the American people understand what this is about, actions such as that would be totally irresponsible. In fact, it would be used to justify the imposition of a dictatorship. So let's, of course, help us get people educated. When the American people understand what it's about and they say no more, that's the time when this whole thing's going to come to a stop.
Maybe otherwise, the man before the poison us.
Wait a minute, Charles, you go ahead and then let Mike. But Charles, what do you want to say?
Maybe we could poison them before they poison us.
All right. Anything else you'd like to say?
No.
Okay, fine. I don't know if you heard Charles. He said maybe we ought to poison them before they poison us.
Before we get to doing that kind of stuff, which the government's all prepared for and which I don't think would work anyway, just how about sending $10 to get this newspaper ad run in the 14 largest cities in the country? That's really having an effect to reach the citizens and wake them up and ask them questions that are making them lose sleep.
And I would second that. I think that this idea of running this ad in all these major newspapers, and the fact you've well over half the way to collecting the money for it. You've already run it one time in the Washington Post. Charles, you know, the important thing is to be involved in the battle, not to be counterproductive. Why don't you just contribute $10 or $20 towards what Michael's doing? I think it's a great idea because he's going to raise awareness in the hearts and minds of literally millions of Americans if he can run these ads. And, you know, they're going to see it. They're going to ask a question. And that's how I got started 41 years ago. I turned on the wrong television program, and maybe other people will just open that newspaper and see it, and they'll begin to think. And that, of course, is the one thing that the other side fears. They fear certainly not people with guns running around in the hills. They fear an awakened and concerned American public. More than anything else, they do not want the American people to begin to think or question or simply ask, why weren't there any planes up in the air on that day of 9/11? What did the government know ahead of time? And if there's nothing to conceal, why does the president insist on his people being on that committee? And, of course, why is it that even when they have a committee, they won't allow them to have any information or much of the information because it's all classified? And then that haunting question, is it that they don't want Muhammad Atta to know what we knew ahead of time? So, I mean, I'm guardedly optimistic. I think that, especially as we're going to see more and more financial turmoil, I think what we're seeing is a very temporary upswing in the market. But, of course, we're a long way from being out of the woods, and the good times are not coming back again, I fear. Nope. And maybe the best thing that can happen is we do go into a major, major recession, and we do find more and more people out of work, because it's going to take something like that before people are going to begin to be willing to become involved in this battle when they realize it's going to affect them as well as our neighbors across the country and around the world.
We're going to be there anyway as a result of peak oil. That's unavoidable.
Amen to that. Well, we've got Jeannie calling, and Jeannie's one of our favorite guests. Hi, Jeannie. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fine. This might be off the subject, but what does this gentleman feel about Hillary Clinton's presidential aspirations, and what does he think of Hillary Clinton as a personality?
All right, fine. That's a little off the subject, but I think it's legitimate. What do you think about Hillary Clinton's presidential aspirations, and what do you think about Hillary Clinton?
Oh, my God. Well, probably the worst thing that we could do would be to think that we're going to solve any problems by throwing out Bush and electing Hillary. I mean, don't forget that the Clintons were hand over fist in drug dealing in MENA, Arkansas, laundering drug money through the Arkansas Development Financial Authority, that Hillary's law firm, the Rose Law Firm, signed and negotiated the CIA contracts at the MENA airport. Both parties are as dirty as the other, and it's very clear from my research in my book that the Clinton administration was very definitely a part of the run-up to 9/11. Many of the plans for the invasion of Afghanistan were begun during the Clinton administration.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. On the other hand, you know, let's imagine that Hillary was the president. There would be, of course, great opposition to her from the conservative Christian right. I mean, there would at least be opposition to what she was doing, and the Republicans would rally against it. The way it is now, the Republicans, who should be opposing almost everything the administration is doing, are going right along with it. And the only people we have there who are opposing the Office of Homeland Security and the move towards dictatorship are the left-wing Democrats. And I hate to be on their side, but on most of these issues, they're doing a lot better job than the Republicans are.
Yeah, well, you know, there are quite a few Christian churches that are not supporting the administration, that are not caught up in this dispensationalist nonsense that somehow we're going to make God like us if we start World War III and go out and kill a bunch of people. I mean, the God that I know and believe in would never ask me to do that. There are a whole bunch of people who, you know, God bless them, are absolutely deluded, believing that George W. is the anointed of God. But there were a great many people who believed that Adolf Hitler was the anointed of God. Fortunately, God is not fooled by any of it. So, you know, I'm rooting for God.
Okay, fine. Jeannie, any other questions?
Well, I just wanted to comment that I heard that even if Hillary is a candidate for the presidency, She would never get in because she never takes orders.
Well, of course, I really don't want a choice between Hillary and George W., because that's sort of like a choice between being shot and being hung.
Oh,
I don't like either alternative.
It's a choice between the Genoveses and the Gambinos. Hillary Clinton is as dirty as the rest of them, and she does take orders from the Bilderbergers, the Trilaterals, and the CFR, and so did Bill Clinton.
Okay, anything else, Jeannie?
That's it.
Okay, fine. Our telephone number again, thanks very much for calling. Our telephone number is, of course, 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. We've been talking about all sorts of things this evening, and specifically about the fact we're running out of oil, we're moving into an energy crisis, and this is probably one of the major motivations for the invasion over there to control the war, oil of Iraq and Iran, and hopefully then to be able to destabilize Saudi Arabia and take over the oil of Saudi Arabia, which will, of course, allow us, at least for a short period of time, to dominate the oil of the world and be able to maintain our military and be able to maintain our empire. But, of course, I certainly oppose the idea of empire. I think it's the last thing in the world we should be doing. I'm sure you've looked into this project for the New American Century Group.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on that?
Well, we have a story about that on the website and written about it extensively, that this is the same gang, Wolfowitz, Pearl, and all these guys who, you know, were writing 10 years ago that we had to immediately or as soon as possible invade Iraq to control its energy resources, et cetera, et cetera. And these are the same people now in the White House. And, of course, there was a very strong Israeli influence in all of this. And I have a chapter in my book on Israel, and I'm very critical of Israel. While I am not one of those people who believes that Israel perpetrated the attacks of 9/11, they couldn't have. I have documented, however, that Israel played a role of accomplice in the attacks at U.S. direction, and that we know, because I have read the entirety of a DEA report that documented an art student ring of Israeli art students who were really intelligence agents in the country. They were performing a multitude of roles, because you piggyback covert operations one within the other. But there were certain aspects of this art ring that were following Mohammed Atta all around the country. They were just literally a couple of doors away from his post office box in Hollywood, Florida. They were following two other hijackers, Al-Hamzi and Al-Madar, in San Diego, who these guys led a charmed life. And the Mossad had actually provided a list to the CIA, naming four of the 9/11 hijackers. But it's clear to me that in the 9/11 attacks, of course, Israel benefited along with the U.S. and Great Britain, but that the Israeli activity was to serve as a plausibly deniable cutout or asset to facilitate the U.S. or the globalist plan of the industrialized powers to control the oil and see that some of the attacks succeeded and some were stopped. I have likened Israel in my book to the Bride of Frankenstein, with the U.S. being Frankenstein and Israel being the bride. And if Frankenstein wants something done he doesn't want to get caught at, you know, he'll send his wife out to do it, and then he'll blame everybody when she gets caught. But on the same token, she's not a very functional person herself. She'll run out and do some nasty things and, you know, try to play against her husband. It's a really unhappy home life. But they're forever wedded to each other. But the key with both Frankenstein and his bride is what made both of them, and that's the financial monetary system, which is really driving things.
And, of course, this is the problem. We have a monetary system that has nothing as its base other than a faith in the American dollar and what it will buy. But if that faith ever begins to become shaken, if, of course, the reserve currency were to change from America to Israel, pardon me, to the euro or the gold dinar, why, of course, our whole infrastructure would come toppling down. I mean, there's people don't understand. They think that there's security and money in the bank or money in a pension fund or money in bonds. But what's behind that money? And, of course, it's faith in the system. And if that faith ever begins to break down, God help us all.
That's very true. And, of course, we have another currency called the Chinese Golden Yuan, which is partially gold-backed, but it's tied to the dollar. And if the Chinese economy gets too strong, all of a sudden, if China allows the yuan to float while the dollar is falling, that could spell the end of it. But I have to be very clear that currencies are nothing more than a weapon now in the worldwide battle for the control of oil reserves. So if the euro or the yuan or gold does a bust out, that will be just a means to weaken a competitor when it comes down to controlling the energy reserves, because obviously if there's no energy, your money is worthless anyway.
Well, amen to that. Of course, I really think that the Chinese probably know that we have released this SARS over there. They're not going to say anything about it. There's nothing much they can do. They're really totally subservient to us. But there is a tremendous hostility. I mean, they will never forgive us for, the Boxer War and the other wars, the humiliation that China, certainly the Opium War. They've got a long, long memory, and with good justification. I mean, right. I certainly think they have been exploited, and of course the fact we brought communism to China back in 1949, 1950, by first blocking Chiang Kai-shek's access to weapons. If you don't have weapons, you can't fight, and even though the United States Congress appropriated $125 million for weapons, which would be several billion dollars in today's funds, why, of course, the State Department wouldn't send them. And when the rifles finally arrived in China, why, of course, they didn't have any bolts in them. They were useless. We brought communism to China and all the suffering that was inherent in that. But the Chinese, of course, have a long memory. And when push comes to shove, they will not be our friends.
I noticed just today, Stan, that Russia and China, the Yukos Oil Company, which is the largest oil company in Russia, have just signed a 25-year, I think it's $4 billion pipeline oil supply agreement. That's very long term, which means that that Caspian oil, which is too little to build a $5 billion pipeline to ship it out to us because it's only 40 billion barrels, will be built on a couple thousand-mile pipeline and sold to China by Russia. And there are developing alliances here against the U.S. I've documented a Moscow-Berlin-Paris alliance that's been building for some time. What's interesting, though, is that Britain is ultimately going to be drawn back into Europe. They have no choice. British Petroleum just signed a major contract that was a mini-merger with the same oil company, Yukos. And that's because Russia has about 60%, 50% of all the natural gas on the planet. And Britain will have to go to Russia to get its natural gas. Britain will be a natural gas, it started importing natural gas this year. And the North Sea fields are all dry. They're all drying up so rapidly that they're laying off people left and right. Shell is shutting down platforms, so is BP. So Britain will have to go back into the European fold. But the problem is that you can't, even if the U.S. controlled the natural gas in Russia, it wouldn't do us any good in the U.S. because you'd have to build something like 3,000 LNG tankers at $100 million a pop, each of which takes about 3 years to build. And you'd have to build the LNG storage facilities, which we don't have in any significance. And every time you convert to LNG and back again, you lose about 20% of the energy. So it's not energy efficient. Gas can, natural gas can really only be transported by pipeline effectively. So there's all these little wild cards being played out in this scenario right now. We don't know where it's going
to
end.
Okay, well, let's go to Claire calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Claire. How are you doing?
Hello. I was just wondering, by the way, it's an extraordinary program you have. I was just wondering if himself sees any hope for any kind of a possible candidate that could possibly get rid of Bush on the Democratic side, or perhaps a third party in this coming election.
All right, of course. The question, did you hear the question at all?
Not completely.
Well, basically, Claire is asking, is there anybody who can get rid of Bush? Is there a possibility of a good Democratic candidate? Is there a possibility of a third party to replace Bush?
Basically, the short answer to all that is no.
In one word, no.
Thanks.
To clarify a little bit, though, I don't see an impeachment as working at all. One of my colleagues and friends, Francis Boyle, a law professor, has drafted articles of impeachment. They're very sound, but there's no way to mobilize the congressional effort necessary. It took 4 or 5 years to mobilize the congressional effort to impeach Clinton. We don't have that kind of time now. And secondly, look at the way the way the country would be left after an impeachment. You would have a non-functioning government. Not only that, you would still be only firing, in effect, the chief executive officer, which does nothing to change the corporate structure of the board of directors. Replacing Bush is entirely possible because there are signs. We had Jay Rockefeller recently, that's John David Rockefeller IV, the senator from West Virginia, call for an FBI investigation of the source of forged documents saying that Saddam Hussein was buying uranium from Niger in Africa, that Bush, Powell, Cheney, Bush even talked about them in his State of the Union address, and they've been shown to be forgeries, which was a sign to me that the Bush administration has kind of messed up a little bit in its handling of affairs. You had Lawrence Eagleburger telling the BBC shortly after the Iraqi invasion that if Bush invaded Syria, he ought to be impeached immediately. Now, Lawrence Eagleburger was the Secretary of State for W's daddy. But all that means is that the board of directors would fire the CEO and bring in a new manager. That's not solving the problem.
No, we've got to replace the board of directors. That's it. And we're not going to do that until people begin to understand the power structure, the financial structure, and really, in my estimation, the evil force behind them. Because unless people understand that there really is organized evil out there, that we're really fighting a spiritual battle being played out on a political and ideological and cultural and economic and educational battlefield, we're never going to be able to face this or even begin to have an impact on this, what's going on.
That's correct. You nailed that one on the head, Stan.
Okay, fine. Oh, now, of course, you have this video. Do you want to put a plug for it? Aftermath 911?
Well, we have Truth and Lies of 9/11. Aftermath was actually produced by some good friends of mine, the Guerrilla News Network up in San Francisco.
Okay, fine. That's okay.
But the Truth and Lies is available on the website at www.fromthewilderness.com, or you can get it. It's $24.95. It's 2.5 hours long with appearances by Congressman Ron Paul, Barbara Lee of Northern California, Cynthia McKinney, a bunch of academics, some really great stuff. That's 2.5 hours. That's at the website or through our toll-free number, which is 1-866-222-7693. And we've got a whole bunch of other great stuff on the website, and that's where you can subscribe also to the newsletter From the Wilderness. We're now 9,000 subscribers strong in 35 countries.
Well, I can remember when you were 4,000, so I think
we've
come a long ways in the last couple of years. And I'm so glad, because the more people are out there getting the information, I don't have the time to do the research that you do, and I'm really looking forward to going on your website and finding out about those scientists who, of course, mysteriously died, and anybody out there in the listening audience who doesn't understand that they kill people, that they might perhaps reveal what's going on. There's no question about it. We have a book called The Dead Witnesses, JFK and the Dead Witnesses. There were over 100 people who witnessed one or another part of the Kennedy assassination, and of course, they were simply liquidated under one term or another. Author, we actually had interviewed a number of times, Jim Keith, a healthy young 30-year-old author who was hitting very hard, died mysteriously after a minor surgical procedure. And, of course, that could have been just a coincidence, but I doubt it was a coincidence that his publisher died a few weeks thereafter, or his ex-wife died a few weeks after that. Do you honestly believe that these things just happened by accident? Well, if you do, why, there's not much hope for you. But I have no question, nor does Michael, that they really will stop at nothing. I think those of us on the front lines risk our lives every day, but you have to do what's right. Well, Michael, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Just that if there's anything that I would think that people need to learn about now to build a map to understand what's driving all of world events, it's understanding peak oil and what it means. And I've got a ton of free articles up on the website, and they're absolutely free. You don't have to be a subscriber to read them at FromTheWilderness.com. Go to The World Since 9/11, and I have a subheading called Oil, and you'll see all the past work that we've done there. I've got newer stuff, including my report on Paris, that'll be for our subscribers, but you don't need that to get the picture. The picture is very clear, and especially after the statements of Matthew Simmons, this energy advisor to the Bush administration, it's very, very clear that that's what's driving everything right now.
God bless you. Thanks so much, Michael. It's been a fascinating 2 hours. We look forward to having you with us again in the not-too-distant future.
Peace, Stan.
Good night. Okay, fine. Michael. Michael Ruppert. I hope you enjoyed it, and please pray for America. Pray for our leaders, and please remember to keep Radio Liberty in your prayers as well. Good night. May the Lord be with you.